Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 27th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And as I've been doing for the last week or two, I'm recording this from a hotel room underneath a blanket, because that's apparently the best way to get good sound when you can't control anything in your hotel room, like the weird refrigerator noises coming from the corner of this room in downtown Wellington. I've been having a really cool traveling kind of working vacation, that's what it's called. I spent some time, I gave a talk actually with Alan Duffy in Melbourne. Yes, that's how you pronounce it. I've been taught by several people it's Melbourne. Also gave a talk in Sydney at the Australian Skeptics Convention and spent some time in the South Island of New Zealand. That was more relaxation and it was amazing. Now I'm up in Wellington about to give a talk here for the NZ Skeptics. Yeah. Said that right too, New Zealand skeptics. And after that, I'm headed to Hong Kong. I'm actually flying to Hong Kong the day that this goes to air. And I'm going to spend some time with the Hong Kong skeptics and I think the Dongguan skeptics there in southern China. All of this travel and all of this speaking is helping to support the podcast, as are sponsorships from listeners like you and from, you know, the sponsors whose ads I read in the middle of the show. All that kind of comes together to make the podcast possible because, of course, I'm doing it all myself. I've recently hired out some help with editing, thank goodness, but still doing a lot of work on my own. And of course, I have to pay the editor. So let me give thanks. It is post-Thanksgiving, after all, for those of you who have been supporting the show so diligently and just so great, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Generously through Patreon. If you are interested in supporting the show, it's www.patreon.com/talknerdy. And at certain levels, you get a shout out at the beginning of the show, like these folks, Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, Christian Jeffrey, Stuart Ogue, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and of course, Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so very much for your support. It means so much to me. And I think it means a lot to everybody listening because without you, I would not have a show. That is for sure. All right, guys, I'm excited about this week's guest. He is a, what would you call him? He's a computational chemist. That's his day job. But his PhD is in theoretical chemical physics. And if you don't know what that means, don't worry, neither did I. We dive into it in the show. But he's also the author of a brand new book, The Cosmic Machine, The Science That Runs Our Universe and the Story Behind It. His name is Dr. Scott Bembenek. And I think you'll be really excited about what he has to say. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Scott Bembenek. Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, Kara, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. So you are the author. You're a physicist, obviously. I don't know if that's obvious to people listening yet, but it might be because I probably already announced you. Time travel. But you are the author of a new book called The Cosmic Machine, The Science That Runs Our Universe and the Story Behind It. How exciting. And also so much work this book must have been.
It was a lot of work. Yeah. You know, it started out as, it started out as kind of a simple project. A friend came to me, you know, I started this actually back in 2010, believe it or not. So I still have my day job. Yeah. Well, you know, I still have my day job as a computational chemist doing some stuff on drug discovery. So this was really like a side project for me. And it started with a friend. She came to me and she had just read a popular science book and she was all excited about it. And I was just amazed that, you know, here was someone that didn't have a science background. They actually didn't read a lot of popular science to begin with, but they just couldn't say enough good things about this popular science book they were reading. And it just got me thinking, you know, could I do something like this? And so I got interested in this and I thought about it and I'm thinking, yeah, I could. And it started out as a very kind of, you know, casual project. I would work on it on the weekends and when I had time. And I don't know, it just, I kind of got more heavily invested and things took off and I wanted more from the book. And yeah, it took quite some time. It just came out this year.
Oh, well, congratulations. And I want to clarify, because I called you a physicist, you called yourself a computational chemist. Your work is in theoretical chemical physics.
Right. So so it's confusing, right?
Yeah, yeah, right?
Many names and many things. So my PhD is in theoretical chemical physics. And then in industry, sometimes this changes up a little bit, right? So it's a little more pragmatic what I do in industry. I use computational techniques, you know, like computer modeling and computer algorithms to try to improve the drug discovery process. So when I'm at work, they think of me as a computational chemist. In general, I think of myself as a theoretical chemical physicist.
Okay, great. So you're in between these two worlds, which of course have a ton of crossover, but we tend to think of them as being, I think, more siloed than they actually are.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, right? We kind of like put names on these things, you know, physicist, chemist, and computational. And, you know, really what I'm doing is kind of bridging all these things. You know, it's a theoretical chemical physicist really, you know, they're kind of in between that interface at chemistry and physics. They throw in the mathematics and when they're doing quote unquote pragmatic things like drug discovery or designing these types of molecules, then they get called computational chemist or physicist.
Yeah. So I had a friend when I was working on my master's in neuroscience who was really into computational chemistry. He was a PhD student. He was in the neuroscience department. So technically he was in like biology, biochemistry, but more and more he was focusing on some of the work that you do. So I feel like I have a sort of decent understanding of what computational chemistry is, but this might be a completely new term to some of my listeners. So let's dive into that a little bit. What is a computational chemist?
Well, so, I mean, that's a good question. So I think that, and it's a pretty broad term, you know, so I think in general, well, first, what is a theoretical chemical physicist? And I think that that's important to understand first. So these are people that usually are looking at molecules and looking at the way these molecules are made up in terms of their atoms and how they're connected. And then what is it about that that gives these molecules their specific properties, their chemical and physical properties? So now computational chemist, specifically one like myself that is trying to, you know, improve the drug discovery process. Specifically, I'm trying to look at a molecule and I'm trying to understand, well, what is it about a molecule that turns it into, you know, a drug, something that you take that's safe for your body and that actually has a therapeutic effect, you know, cures a disease or, you know, some other therapeutic effect. So it's really about, you know, I guess the computational part, it's really, you know, taking those tools that you have in chemistry and physics and applying it to a specific problem. You know, computational chemists do a lot of different things. You know, like I said, I'm in drug discovery, but in general, it's really about using the chemistry and physics, probably with computer modeling and computer algorithms to solve a specific problem.
And so those kinds of problems generally have to do with needing certain types of drugs. I mean, would you call this drug design or is it a little bit more broad than that?
Well, it's a little bit. So I think a computational chemist, it's actually a very broad term. I think the commonality in the term is really that they're, you know, they're looking at what is it about a molecule that endows it with certain properties. Now, for me, as a computational chemist and drug discovery, I'm being a little more specific. I want to know what endows that molecule. What is it about its atomic makeup, the atoms that, you know, make it up into a molecule? What is it about that that lends it to being a drug? So I think that, you know what I mean? It's so computational chemists in general are thinking about, you know, molecules and their atomic makeup. They may be actually thinking about a collection of such molecules. And then how do these molecules as a group, you know, interact and the types of physical and chemical properties that they give when they're acting as a group, as opposed to a single molecule. But, you know, in drug discovery, so we call it, you know, computer-aided drug discovery or computational chemist and drug discovery. So yeah, so I'm focusing more on those types of things. But I think the common connection for computational chemistry is that they're looking at more of the, you know, the atomic properties and things like this. I mean, contrast it with, I think that when people think about physics in general these days, they often think kind of the other end of the spectrum in terms of things like black holes and astrophysics and superstring theory and these theories of everything. So kind of like these grand big scale things, right? But a theoretical chemical physicist or a computational, you know, chemist, you know, when it's reduction to practice, if you will, is looking more at the smaller scale, you know, looking at the atoms that actually make up a molecule and how these atoms actually give it these certain chemical and physical properties. You know, that's kind of in general. So it's kind of a different scale, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the cool thing about physics, right? Is that it really runs the gamut from what we think of as more sort of chemistry, these super, super, super small things. But even in physics, sometimes you get down to like really small things, like subatomic things.
Oh, yeah,
and then
absolutely.
It can go huge, you know, to these kind of cosmic scales. All of these scales, very difficult for us to understand, sort of because of our evolutionary past. But it's super cool that you're working in this kind of sweet spot in an applied way, where I guess the thinking is that historically, drug discovery was just that. It was discovery. Like you would maybe find some sort of natural molecule, something that existed, you know, as a fungus or something that existed in bacteria and apply it and see, oh, holy crap, it binds to this one receptor and it seems to have a downstream effect in humans and can help with certain types of sickness. But now that we know exactly what those receptors look like and we understand all of the downstream stuff, we can sort of reverse engineer a molecule that would fit really nicely.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, I mean, you have a very good understanding of this, right? So I think back in the day, it was exactly how you described. Well, you can imagine, you know, many, many, many years ago, centuries, you know, millennia, whatever year, you know, ago, the people, this was all experimental thing, right? You would, you had a problem, some kind of something that was ailing you, and you would take a plant and you would eat it and you'd hope that it would help you.
Yeah.
Or at least not hurt you, right? And so obviously we've evolved quite far past that. And now we have a clear understanding of, you know, the actual composition of these things, you know, the molecules that make up maybe a natural product. But now we can try to mimic these natural products by going into the lab and designing molecules that kind of look like them and then trying to shape them into something that has a therapeutic effect. And like you said, we understand, I mean, our understanding of the biology and the biological pathways is phenomenal. You know, that was actually something that I didn't have a big understanding of when I started in drug discovery. And now that's, you know, that's another area that I'm very exposed to. And it's very interesting when you pull all these things together and you have all these tools.
Absolutely. Especially because I think so much, we think of kind of biology, chemistry, physics as like a layered, applied understanding of the universe, right? Or theoretical even, but we usually think of like sort of physics as being the fundamental stuff, the underlying subatomic stuff. And then we think of chemistry as growing, as being on top of that. And then biology as being more applied. But the truth of the matter is it runs up and down, left and right. They're all intertwined and marbled together. And the job that you do has a really good, kind of takes a really good bite out of all of these different fields.
Well, it kind of does. Yeah. I mean, I like the way you explained that. I mean, it's interesting. We talk about physics as kind of, it's the end all, it's the everything. And, you know, I don't think of it so much like this, right? Because like you say, these things are all intertwined, right? I mean, one of the reasons I became a chemical physicist was I liked working at that interface or, you know, with the chemistry and the physics. You know, I'm not so much about the distinction. I like having the tools of chemistry, the tools of physics, you throw in the mathematics and make it theoretical or what have you. And then, like I said, now that I've been in drug discovery for so long, I mean, the exposure to the biology, which was something I had very little exposure to before I, you know, entered the field, it's, you know, that's a whole another set of tools and you bring them together and you can do some amazing things, you know, and I like working in those different areas. I like being able to kind of move freely, if you will, between those things and leverage all the different learnings and tools, as opposed to saying, well, I'm doing physics or I'm doing chemistry. I don't know. You're doing it all or whatever.
Absolutely. And so are we allowed to, in this podcast, you know, before we really dig into the book, are we allowed to talk at all about, you know, some of the things that maybe you have worked on or are currently working on, like some of the problems that you're attempting to solve?
Well, in general, yeah. I mean, I can talk about, I mean, so the areas I spend a lot of time working on are in immunology and a little bit of oncology. So for example, diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, or I actually do a little neuroscience, so a little bit of Alzheimer's, not currently, but in my past life, we worked on therapies for Alzheimer's, you know, mood disorders, things like this. So actually quite a broad mix. So that's another nice thing is, as a computational chemist, unlike a medicinal chemist, so someone that goes in the lab, I'm not kind of locked into a certain group. I'm not working just in immunology or just in oncology or neuroscience. I get to move freely between all these different groups and learn about the different biology and the different therapeutics there. So yeah, I'm kind of working on a variety of different things within those fields.
So neat. And you have the added bonus that a lot of scientists don't always get to experience of doing really, really applied work, meaning that, you know, there's a real outcome that's tangible, that's measurable, that, you know, it's not a far stretch from what you do to eventually really helping people, as opposed to the super, super basic research that often scientists are involved in, which is incredibly important as well. But it does sometimes feel like there's a big disconnect between the ultimate outcome.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. Yeah. So I have a lot of friends in academics, and we have this conversation often. I mean, they'll often, you know, I'll often reflect on how I wish I was doing more academic-like things or being able to dive a little bit deeper into something more specific. And they'll come back with, yeah, but, you know, I wish, you know, my research was a little more applied and I could see more immediate application to it. I do like the applied stuff. I mean, you know, I like sitting and working in the theoretical hardcore stuff and things like this. That is my original background. But I also like having, you know, where you take those learnings and you actually apply it and you can solve a problem that can have real impact potentially.
Absolutely. So I'd love to talk about your book because based on what we've been discussing so far, it feels a bit like a departure, but it probably isn't in your mind. And I'm sure you can explain to me why that is. But again, it's called The Cosmic Machine, The Science That Runs Our Universe and the Story Behind It. So like, first of all, what's the cosmic machine?
Well, that's a good question. So, and I got a few questions on that and people asked about the title. It was, so the title kind of came from, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, the Cosmic Machine. I talk about how we had these two different philosophies at one point where we thought the world was very deterministic and it moved like a machine, and they called it the mechanical philosophy. And then at the other end of the spectrum, around the same time, we also had this more kind of a spiritual philosophy, which was alchemy. And so these were kind of these competing philosophies, but they had actually a very nice overlap, and actually well-known physicists like Newton dabbled in both, which was very interesting to me. So when I thought of the title and things like this, I started thinking the world was kind of like, you know, kind of a mix of both, right? It's not, it has deterministic laws, but at the same time, we have a lot of unknown and uncertain things, especially when we get down to the quantum world that we really don't know about. And so I tried to pull that together and say, it's more like this cosmic machine, if you will.
Interesting. Okay. And so it really does kind of have a lot of important fundamental components, a lot of philosophical components that are sort of threaded together to tell this story.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, I try to tell, so it's really like a collection of science stories. And because I wanted to not just talk about the science, but I wanted people to really appreciate the process of scientific discovery. So I talk a lot about the scientists themselves and you know, what were they thinking and how did they come up with these ideas? Why were they even thinking about these ideas? So I try to give a little bit of the backstory in terms of the history and the biography. And then I picked four major topics in chemistry and physics to focus on because I wanted to focus on what I think is more kind of the foundational science. You know, like of, so I talked about energy and entropy and atoms and quantum mechanics. And then I split those into chapters and sections and kind of dig down deep into them. So it's a little bit different than, I think, like, once again, going back to what we talked about before, I think when people pick up popular science these days, they see a lot of, you know, parallel universes and relativity is a big topic. And of course, unified theories and superstring theories. And those are great
holes,
things.
Right.
And black holes and astrophysics. Mm-hmm. And these are great topics. You know, we got some great spokesmen out there for that. But I wanted to give people a totally different flavor of, you know, of science, specifically chemistry and physics. And I wanted to really go with what I think is the more foundational science. So if you weren't ever to read another science book, you could read this and you would feel like, I learned quite a bit. I could build upon this if I was interested to do so, or I've actually learned a lot already. Maybe I'll put it down for a while.
Absolutely. And I think that's important because a lot of people who didn't have the opportunity, like myself, who, you know, I mostly studied neuroscience and psychology. So I'm sort of really lacking in my foundational physics understanding. And so this gives you a really great background of sort of like what we think of as classical or Newtonian physics, but then it also builds upon that so that we understand a little bit more about quantum mechanics and how these things sometimes play nice and sometimes don't play that nice.
Well, that's right. So, right, it started with the classical mechanics and I tried to like shape it into a story and kind of give a little bit of the history and show, you know, what people were thinking about and struggling with. And then towards the end of the book, kind of, you know, we evolved towards more, difficult or weird and strange quantum mechanics.
Yeah, right. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, the weird, strange,
sure.
difficult, I don't know, quantum mechanics and trying to make sense out of that stuff, which...
And is that something that you studied a lot when you were in academia, or was it sort of difficult when you sat down to write this portion to go back and re-review a lot of these things and maybe even learn new things that you hadn't learned before?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So actually, I mean, I had a lot of quantum mechanics when I was in graduate school. So I took quantum from both the chemistry department and the physics department, which was nice because I got a flavor, you know, they treat it differently and they think about different problems. But I did go back and, you know, look at certain things in more detail. And it was really interesting, you know, like I said, whereas the science I was probably very familiar with and some of the major players, you know, like Einstein and these guys, the underlying history wasn't so familiar to me, you know, and it was actually a real treat for me to learn about these things, learn about the history and just learn about the biography of these, you know, brilliant men and women and the things they were thinking about, you know, just the kind of the fundamental concepts of how did they even arrive at, you know, these ideas? Why were they even thinking about this stuff?
Yeah, you know, I think most of us who have gone through a more traditional academic course maybe had to take one class in whatever our discipline was in history and systems of that discipline. And, you know, I think some departments are better about it, some professors are better about it, but it's interesting how divided it is. It's sort of like, here's all the concepts and the theory and the applied stuff. And then here's a little bit about the history and some of the theoretical underpinnings, but you don't always learn them together. And it's like the weirdest approach, because learning about the history of these things is what makes the application fundamentally interesting. It's what makes it come to life. Yet we often learn about the history in a way that's so dull.
Well, so, I mean, that's a great point. So now you've really kind of hit on something I think a lot about. So it's, you know, you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, I mean, when I learned it, and I think when a lot of people learn science, whether it's in, you know, high school or middle school, or even in college, you're learning, it's really these facts, right? These kind of bare bone, raw facts that are stripped of anything interesting, mm-hmm. you know, and then even worse, you probably have to memorize them so you can recall them for a test. And I think this turns a lot of people off to science. And I think that, you know, for some kids, I think that'll be their only exposure to science, which is really sad, because there's an amazing story around this, right? I mean, there's, you know, but we don't tell this story, and it's something we totally leave out, and we just kind of throw these science facts at people, tell them to memorize it, you're going to be tested on it. And, you know, and people are sitting there thinking, well, who cares about these things, you know? But I think that if we told more of the story and we told more of the scientists, you know, and we realized that these scientists are a lot like you and I, you know, they struggle with lots of stuff. Yeah, I mean, they solve brilliant problems and things like this. But if you look at their lives and you look with, you know, look at the way they struggle through their life and struggle with their work, I think a lot of us could really relate to that. And I think when you relate to that, you know, it kind of humanizes the science a little bit more. You start getting a little more invested and interested in the science through the scientist. And then when you hear the greater story. But unfortunately, I don't, you know, that's not something that often comes through, I don't think.
Oh, absolutely. So is this the first book that you've written?
It is.
Oh, how exciting. And was working on this book in a way your first foray into sort of public science communication, or have you for a while been dabbling in that world?
No, I haven't. I just, this is my first attempt at, you know, trying to communicate science to a general audience.
Well, that's really exciting. You know, that's sort of my world is public
yes.
science communication. And I feel like I have tentacles in every aspect of this world. But when I first started in it, I had sort of, I think, a similar experience that a lot of other science communicators have, which is I was like, I am the only person who does this for a living. Like, I remember
right.
getting a job at Huffington Post and doing a video series and thinking like, ah, I'm going to bring science to them. And then I realized there's so many other incredible people who do this and who do it really well. And I could learn from them and I could talk to them. And so I guess my question is, when you started working on this book, and then of course, after the publication, and now that it's sort of existing in the world, are you connecting with more science communicators? Are you like learning from them? They're learning from you. Has it broadened up a little bit of your sort of sphere?
Yeah, it really has, because, you know, it's interesting. I, Yeah, and you asked, and actually, no, I wasn't doing any science communication type work before. Everything that mm-hmm. I wrote was, you know, for scientific publications or presenting at a meeting, you know, to my colleagues on, you know, certain specific scientific ideas. So this was
absolutely.
My really,
yeah. By I the mean, way, so that's a, I have to just interject and say that there is the third article listed under your publications is called, I'm going to attempt this simply because it will be fun.
Okay.
Pharmacological characterization of 1,5-chloro-6-trifluoromethoxy, 1-H-benzoidazole, 2-YL-1-H, pyrazole, 4-carboxylic acid, and then a bunch of numbers and letters, a potent and selective HIF prolyl hydroxylase PhD inhibitor. Was that okay?
That's very good. That's impressive. That's impressive. Wow.
I have no idea what any of the words I just read mean, but I've
just
seen
all fancy stuff. It's
right. I've seen all the prefixes and suffixes before. But yeah, so this is the world that you were publishing in, and that is grossly different. Like, I'm getting back into my PhD studies right now, and so I'm having to relearn how to write for a scientific audience because I've been doing writing for a public audience for so long. And it's like, you don't get to use adjectives. You have to use intense jargon and make your sentences so terse and so dense that you have to read them 5 times to get all of the information out of them. And it's like the opposite when you write for a public audience.
Yes, exactly, right? So no, I found it to be a big challenge. I mean, I sat down, I started thinking about, you know, up until the book, I was writing, like I said, I was writing the scientific papers, kind of like the ones you were talking about, you know, for my colleagues, people in my field are going, you know, going to meetings and talking to these people. And it's a totally different thing, right? Like we talked about earlier, you're not telling a story. You're keeping it very, like you say, there's no adjectives, no nothing. You know, that's like a no-no, right? I mean, if you start writing your scientific publications like that, the editor starts crossing that out and tightening up your sentences, that's out, you know, and it comes down to the idea that, you know, science is really about sticking to the facts, you know, so that we can have a clear picture of what the facts are and draw the conclusions. And that's great for doing the science and drawing major conclusions, but it doesn't make anything interesting, right? I mean, even the scientists in the, well, I mean, it's a great system. And I think this is part of the reason why, you know, when people learn it in school, you know, scientists aren't taught to present it in another way. And so that's why kids, you know, go to school and they're taught this way in college or high school and middle school. You know, it's not a criticism. It's just that scientists aren't taught that. And I had the same problem. I mean, I'm sitting thinking, I mean, up until the book, the longest thing that I had written was my thesis, you know, and that was on super, super cool liquids and glasses and the glass transition and, you know, all these things. And, you know, there's nothing interesting. There's no good story in there. I mean, there's some interesting facts and some conclusions, but it's not an interesting story for anyone outside the field. And so I had to spend a lot of time really kind of learning a new skill set, you know, learning new language, learning a new presentation style, trying to think, you know, how would this be interesting to someone that had never heard it before? It's a totally, I mean, as you know, it's a totally different thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a trial and error process. And the great thing about a book is that you get to iterate within it, you know, until you get where you need to be and then present it to the world. And of course, if you're lucky enough to have a very good editor, that can be incredibly helpful.
Yes, yes. Having a good editor is very important. Or a couple editors. The problem is you're thinking, it's just when you think you got it all figured out and you're really good. No.
Yeah.
Get your editor in there so they can tear it up and, you know, some lessons learned.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's tough. It's like, it's a really big undertaking. I haven't done it yet. I've been working with a lot of editors, a lot of publishers to try and get myself into a headspace where, you know, I have the idea, it's fleshed out enough that I can really bite it off. But at the same time, when you're, you know, a full-time student, you're working full-time, like just like you, you know, you had, you have a day job, you have an important day job, and it's really difficult. That's probably why it took you how many years to write this?
Well, almost 7 years to get it out, right? I mean, I started thinking at the end of 2009, started actually sitting down and writing it out in 2010. It's a big undertaking, right? Especially, I think in general, but then if you're doing it part-time, you know, I mean, it's doable, but it's, it's a big undertaking, you know, and originally I thought it was going to be, so the joke that I keep telling people is I thought it was going to be something I would wrap up in about 2 years. you know, and obviously I missed that mark, you know, many, many times. And it became this thing where you kept saying, well, this is going to be the year, or this is going to be the year. And it's like, okay, well, maybe not. You know, it's just one of those things. It almost, you know, at first it's like you're not so invested. And then at some point it's like, it's almost like it's the book is controlling you. You know, you've, you know, I had a friend that was writing at the same time, and he had this joke. He's like, well, who's writing who here? Who controls who? You know, man, it becomes this weird kind of dynamic. Mm-hmm. You know, like you thought you could put this down anytime you wanted. And actually at some point it's like, well, gosh, I don't think I can. It's like something's pulling me to write this, you know, and it's so it's a very interesting experience. You can definitely do it part time, but I think I drove a few people crazy in my life, you know, well, because you start carving out, you know, you start investing more time, you know, weekends turned into both days on the weekend, and that turned into after work, you know, that whatever time you could squeeze out after work. And then you start taking time off from work to do this. This is your quote unquote vacation, you know, and you're trying to explain to your friends and family, and they think you're nuts, but it's good. It's a great experience. I mean, it's kind of like one of those, it's kind of a love-hate thing, or that's what I felt.
Every author I've talked to, because I feel the same way, I'm always like, I don't actually want to write a book. I just want to have written a book.
Yeah, well, exactly. So see, you totally get it. I mean, that's exactly what I was feeling. It's like, at some point, it's like, yeah, right. You want this to be done. It's not done. And you keep saying, I'm going to quit today. I'm going to quit. You know, every day I'm going to quit. I got to this weird point where, you know, I'm telling my wife, yeah, I'm just going to quit this whole thing. She's like, no, you're not. She goes, just get up there and start writing. You say this every day. You know, you're just having one of those weeks or months or whatever. And then, you know, at some point you get past that and you're like, okay, no, I'm in it. You know, I'm going to feel that feeling, but I'm still going to do it because, yeah, there's just something about it. I mean, I think that it really made me personally a better scientist because I had to go back to all these ideas in science that I think I would like to think I had a very good understanding of. But now you strip away, you know, all that vocabulary that you usually use when you talk to, you know, your peers and your colleagues, and you strip away kind of that lingo. It's almost like a foreign language. You get rid of that. And now how are you going to explain that idea? How are you going to explain quantum mechanics now?
Absolutely. And sometimes I do find when I'm doing this kind of communication work, and I'm interested if you have the same experience, where the vocabulary and the way that we talk about these things, so much information is tied up into it. You know, it is the definition of terse. It's like a single word can describe an entire concept or an entire theory. So much of that is a given in it that you can sort of get away with not really understanding it at a truly fundamental level, but still sound like you know it. And then when you strip that away and you have to start explaining it at a level that you can't use any of that, you realize, gosh, I don't think I understand this as well as I thought I did.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you make a great point. Yeah, I felt that, and I feel that sometimes when I'm talking to people, you know, there's this common language that you learn and we just kind of take for granted that, oh, if they use those words and that terminology or put it together in this way, they must understand what's going on, you know, or if they're not explaining it well, it's not them actually not explaining it well, it's me not understanding it. It's kind of a weird thing. Mm-hmm. But when you, like you say, it's very terse, but when you get rid of all of that and you just have to use, you know, everyday language or everyday examples, it forces kind of a new way of thinking. I mean, I found myself sitting and thinking about, you know, basically writing something down and then kind of crossing out like, oh, no, I'm still using that language, you know, my more familiar jargon, scientific jargon, and then rewriting it and thinking about it. And it's a whole different, for me personally, it was a whole different level of understanding once you could kind of get it down to more of a fundamental level, mm-hmm. you know, where you could explain it to everybody. But I don't like to say, but you're not dumbing it down, right? I mean, I've seen things where people write like that, you know, and it drives me nuts, and, you know, because
it also is no longer accurate. Like sometimes if you make it so simple that you actually lose accuracy, that's really dangerous.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. No, and that drives me nuts. I mean, it's kind of like you got to find kind of that lowest common denominator, but you can't slip below that point where it's not even accurate, or you're having to sugarcoat things, you're kind of brushing over things, and now you've lost some of the fundamental science. So it's a real challenge. You're kind of dancing back and forth between these things.
I think dumbing down is actually like a really bad goal. And I see it a lot when I'm working in television. You'll have producers who are, you know, talking to a scientist and I'm interviewing
them. No, I can imagine.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, can you dumb it down? I'm like, oh, don't say that. It's going to piss me off. You know, and it's like, that's also not what we want. Because the truth of the matter is, you know, my number two rule, and I say this all the time on the podcast, and so I probably sound like a broken record, but when I teach science communication, my number one rule is to know your audience. That's obviously incredibly important. You have to know who you're speaking to and you can tailor the way you speak to them. But number two is to never underestimate the intelligence of your audience, but always underestimate their vocabulary. Because the truth of the matter is, these concepts are not so esoteric. They're not like so incredibly intellectually challenging that people without a background can't grasp them. They just don't have all of the freaking vocabulary to be able to talk about them. But when you talk about fundamental rules in science, many times they're very elegant. They're quite simple to understand if we as science communicators use appropriate language to do so.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, I hate that. I hate that phrase, dumbing it down, because like you say, your audience isn't dumb. They don't need that. That's the wrong thinking and the wrong approach. If that's, you know, you simply don't know your audience. It's really about, you know, you need to come up with the common vocabulary. You need to come up with the right examples that they can really connect to, you know, and that's challenging. I found it challenging.
Absolutely. And it kind of parallels, I think, an experience that a lot of people have if they've ever taught in academia, that you really didn't understand or you didn't know what your gaps in your knowledge were until you turned around and tried to teach these concepts that maybe you lived, you know, in your experience all the time, that you worked on in the lab all the time. Let's say I remember teaching like glycolysis, right? I don't know if anybody remembers glycolysis from their biology days. But when I, you know, was tasked with teaching that process to my students, and I was like, ooh, buddy, like I have so much research to do. Because really to be able to break something down to all of its component parts, to come up with the right metaphors, to be able to tell these stories appropriately, it requires that you know this stuff like the back of your hand. And we can get away not really knowing it for a long time in life.
No, I think it's actually really interesting, right? I mean, and I felt that too. I mean, I went back to stuff that I learned, you know, in college and grad school, and I felt, you know, pretty good in my understanding. But when you have to break it down into a different way and you have to totally, you know, explain it in a whole new, you know, a whole new way using new words and stuff, it's different. And I think it's more honest. You're being more honest with yourself. You start thinking, okay, well, maybe I had a certain level of understanding, but maybe it wasn't as good as I thought, you know, maybe. And so that's, for me personally, like we talked about earlier, it's, I think that writing the book actually helped me become a better scientist for this reason, because I, you know, you're not kind of hiding, you know, behind your vocabulary anymore. You're not hiding behind this lingo anymore. You're just saying it the way it is at some point, once you finally find that sweet spot, and then you can connect to your audience. And then you also are being more honest with yourself about what you do and do not understand.
I want to quote you on that so that when I'm teaching science communication to scientists, like I often do, I have sort of a better motivating principle there, because, you know, there is still a certain sect within the scientific community, generally an older sect, that is sort of resistant to science communication. And the fact that, like, I've never thought to reinforce it that way to them, that, like, the better you get at science communication, the better you are as a scientist. Like, in a way, you can really look at it as a selfish endeavor as a scientist, because it will improve your capabilities on that end as well.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, and that was a big reason, like you say, the selfish part of the book for me, it was really, I thought if nothing else, it would improve me as a scientist for this very reason. You know, I wouldn't be able to hide behind my vocabulary. I would have to be brutally honest with myself now about, you know, the things that I really did and did not understand as far as the chemistry and physics, you know. And that was a, you know, rude awakening. But I find it really nice. It's very fulfilling, because when you go back to these ideas, you have a new way to really view them, to, you know, you have access to them in a whole different way, a more fundamental way, I think. And so that was actually a very nice part of this.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break from the show to thank my newest sponsor, The Great Courses Plus. I'm so excited to be working with them. I love learning. I love learning from interesting people. That's why I do this show. And I think that's why you guys listen to this show. And I have had so much fun. I've been so inspired using the Great Courses Plus app. This is a video and an audio streaming service. It's a place where you get unlimited access and you can learn from award-winning professors and experts about every single thing. There's over 8,500 lectures on so many different subjects. You can actually watch it from your TV, your laptop, your tablet, your smartphone, or I like to use the app. That's why I mentioned that, because you can stream audio and that way you can be like working out or, you know, doing things where it requires your eyes, but you can still be learning. There's a really great course that I've been following lately. It's called The Theory of Everything, The Quest to Explain All Reality. It's taught by Dr. Don Lincoln, who's actually a senior scientist at Fermilab. Kind of can't get more cred than that. And he kind of goes back to the basics from Newton to Einstein and looks at all sorts of physics topics that seem really daunting, but are actually super profound and really accessible, you know, helping us understand electricity and magnetism, moving up all the way to sort of wave particle duality into, gosh, you know, the weak force. Let's see. I haven't even gotten here yet, but eventually I'm going to be learning about quarks and leptons. I'll let you know how well I follow that. But it's really great. It really is kind of the story of our quest to find a unified theory of everything. And I want you guys to be able to learn from him as well, to experience the Great Courses Plus the way that I do. So this is special just for you, the Talk Nerdy listeners. You get a free month of unlimited access to enjoy all of their courses, but you've got to use my special URL. It's thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. I'm going to say that one more time, thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. Talk Nerdy is also sponsored by ZipRecruiter. And guys, if you are running your own business, if you're working in HR for a business, small or large, I highly recommend ZipRecruiter for all your hiring needs. You can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but it only takes one click. And then ZipRecruiter uses their smart matching technology to actively notify qualified candidates about the job posting within just minutes. That's why it's different, because on other hiring sites, the right candidates have to like comb through and find you, or you have to go out and find them. But with ZipRecruiter, they actively find the candidates for you. And that's why you get qualified matches. I mean, 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a high quality candidate through the site in just one day. It's absolutely the smartest way to hire. And right now, guys, you can post on ZipRecruiter for free. All you've got to do is go to ZipRecruiter.com/nerdy. Once again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So let's talk a little bit about the, you know, I love to get meta and talk to all, I have authors on the show all the time and I love to talk to them about their process and things like that because I think it's cool to peel back that curtain. But of course, I don't want to ignore the actual content of The Cosmic Machine. And you mentioned like a good way to look at this book is sort of four chunks that are really important fundamental things to understand if you want to understand the physical world: energy, entropy, atoms, and quantum mechanics. Was there, a unit, a section that was easier for you to write? Was there a unit or a section that was more difficult for you to write? Like, how did you approach these four concepts?
That's a good question. So I think the most difficult, so we can start with that, was absolutely the quantum mechanics was probably the most difficult. You know, it's, mm-hmm. I mean, if I was going to be honest about this, it actually ended up, and it's really interesting. I'm not sure if this is why this happened, but it ended up being much longer than the other parts, you know, almost twice as long. And I guess I just felt like I needed more space or more whatever time, if you will, to tell the story. And so, the quantum mechanics was definitely harder. The topics evolved over time. And then just how to approach these topics kind of evolved over time. I had other things I was thinking I would put in, and then I took them out. And a big part of this was, like I said, I thought that this would kind of form more of the foundation of chemistry and physics. And I also thought that there was a certain timeline, that these things kind of really evolved. You could start in time with energy and then evolve towards, you know, at the end towards quantum mechanics. So they really put together a very nice timeline along with the history.
Yeah,
as far as science.
they build on one another, right? Like you probably wouldn't recommend somebody sit down and read the fourth section before reading the first section.
Well, that's right. And I mean, I've had people do that. And I'm like, well, you know, I'd like to tell you that they're standalone. And I think to a certain extent they are. But ideally, you would start from the beginning because there's a story and they do build off of each other.
Yeah, like I could see being able to read them as standalones if you have already a background. But if you're really new, this is your kind of first introduction to these fundamental ideas that really describe the nature of our world, of our universe. Like maybe let's start at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. Why not?
Not a bad idea. Yeah, right? Why not?
It's always a good idea.
And I think it's so great that there are so many options and opportunities for individuals. And I think that yours is one of these great kind of foundational opportunities to be able to sort of make up for a little bit of lost academic time. You know, so many people find themselves working in jobs that require a lot of mental energy, but they have children maybe who are learning things in school. And there's almost like, I don't know, like you're a little bit green with envy, right? Saying like, gosh, I wish I had paid more attention, or I wish that I had the sort of intellectual capabilities then, or maybe the wisdom, or maybe the ability to focus, or all of the things that we get with growth, that we get with adulthood. Yet it's the weirdest thing. Like in our society, we really only kind of prioritize learning in children.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, that's a really good point. I guess you're right, right? Because there's kind of that sweet spot in your life where, you know, when you're in school, where you actually, it's prioritized. And then you can stretch that out, I guess, if you go to college, then you kind of get an extension. And then, you know, if you go into graduate school, you know.
But you have to choose to focus in these areas, you know, and so many people who are like,
that's true.
Yeah, you're an engineer, or let's say you're a teacher, or let's say that you are in sales for a corporation, or let's say that you do, you know, physical manual labor. Like you maybe never really had the opportunity to learn anything about physics, you know, something that's really important and really fundamental, except for like maybe a few years in middle school, a few years in high school, when you were being bombarded with so much information. And sure, your brain was spongier then, right? And you were able to absorb a lot more than maybe you can now. But at the same time, you were to capacity and you didn't have the wisdom of like philosophical knowledge. You know, that's the other thing. I think sometimes we learn about things at the wrong stages in our life, and it's important that we learn about them, but they're adapted to what we're capable of really taking away from them at that time. And a lot of these really fundamental physics principles that are, you know, translate to really big picture issues, really, I don't think are as meaningful to us until we're a little bit older.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, it's unfortunate that we don't have like a natural mechanism, I guess, where people can go back after, you know, some point of being away from school. I guess, like you're saying, being away from school where that sweet spot in your life of learning is kind of, well, quote unquote, passed you by. But you know, yeah, it's nice to be able to, like, as you are an adult and, like you say, have a different philosophical perspective or you've learned just other things, to be able to go back. There isn't such a natural mechanism, I guess, you know, other than, you know, self-learning, you know, teaching yourself, picking up a book and that. I think more people are doing that, but, you know, and it should be more of a natural, people should feel like they can do that, right? And I'm not sure how accessible that kind of is to people.
It's true. You know, this kind of lifelong learning ideal, which I feel like we're pretty lucky living in the century that we're living in because we have such connectivity and we have so many options available to us. You know, we can log into the great courses and we can see these incredible lectures, or we can, you know, use all these other internet-based tools. We can read. There are so many books, like, and so many good books. You know, sometimes I think we require gatekeepers, filters. You know, I think this podcast hopefully serves as that for a lot of people. People tell me all the time, like, gosh, my entire reading list comes from your podcast.
Oh,
and it
great.
Makes me feel really good, right? Because there is so much out there that sometimes it's hard to to narrow it down and know what to focus on. But I really try to make sure that I have people on the show like yourself who can really teach me something. And I think who can teach the listener something. And books like The Cosmic Machine are just so important, I think, for maintaining this well-rounded perspective and for feeling like, I don't know, like maybe I put in a little bit of work and I got to walk away with this really positive experience of having expanded my knowledge base. Like, you almost can't put a price tag on that, can you?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, if you sit down with a book that you feel like you not only you enjoyed it, but it kind of challenged you to that point where you grew and you learned something new. That's pretty invaluable, right? I don't know how you put a price tag on that.
Absolutely. And I think it's important for us as sort of existing being adults who are also really interested in being lifelong learners. I mean, I think the Talk Nerdy community pretty much exemplifies that as much as you can, to have this really well-rounded approach. Like, I sometimes struggle with that because I tend to read books like yours exclusively. And like, to my detriment, I don't read enough fiction. And
yeah,
I mean?
So
we need
me.
Both,
that's me.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. I would say you're right. So I'm terrible at reading fiction. I don't. and it's funny. And it's always been this way. I remember when I was a kid, like when I was in first grade, and I would go to the library, and I would always pick up something on science. You know, how to build this or do that, and you know, I was always checking out these things. And it was funny. One day, I go in to do this again. And the librarian had, you know, she had seen this so many times. And she says to me, wouldn't you like to check out, I forget what she suggested, some, you know, fiction book. Wouldn't you like to read like a story? And do, I go, no, I want to learn stuff. You know,
She
kind of just looked at me and just, okay, let me go. And
yeah,
you know, but it's,
as if we don't learn things from reading fiction, because I think that we
well,
have
right,
to be really
and you
careful.
Do.
Yeah, of
Absolutely.
Course you do. And there are some great stories. I mean, obviously, when I think about my favorite fiction books, it's like Flowers for Algernon and like books that still have like a strong science.
Yeah, that's right. That's kind of funny.
It is interesting. I'm looking at my bookshelf right now while I'm talking. Well, my multiple bookshelves in my office, and there's like small cubes dedicated to fiction, but like the vast majority is nonfiction. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you might be better than me. I'm afraid that I'm looking at my bookshelf now, and it's a lot of math and physics
and that's important,
you know,
too.
Science history stuff, but I guess I'm getting my fiction from TV, which
yeah,
is probably
right.
not necessary. It's probably not good, but just going to be honest
watching?
There. And
can I ask you, what
gosh,
are you watching right now?
That's hilarious. So I got into watching a lot of this, the historical drama stuff, you know, or like these...
That's not fiction.
But the historical fiction type shows.
Oh, okay, good.
You know,
like dramatized.
Like Downton Abbey or something
Oh, good, good, good. Okay, cool.
So I don't know. And it's really funny. So several years ago, I started watching Downton Abbey after a friend suggested it. And I was already aware of the show, but it put it off. And I was on travel in China. It was one of the shows I could watch, actually. And so I started watching this and I'm like, oh, I love this. And so now I watch these types of, I guess, historical fictions are what they're calling them. And it's interesting. So this is where a lot of my fiction's coming from. So I watch things like Outlander, I guess is a big one that I'm watching these days. You know, I love Mr. Selfridge. You know, after I watched Downton Abbey, I think Amazon said, oh, you'll probably like this too. And I'm like, oh, Amazon, you know me so well. So.
I know, right?
And so, you know, this is funny though. This is what's happening. And I just started recently doing a lot of this. So yes, it looks like a lot of my fiction is coming from this.
I get it. I mean, you know, and I do tend to watch like a lot of documentaries, which is like, still nonfiction. But yeah, we just finished Stranger Things season 2.
So do you like that? I watched one and I put it down, but I'm trying to get back to it.
Love, love, love Stranger Things.
Okay.
Yeah, it was great. And I just finished recently, which is sort of dramatized history, but Mindhunter, which was so well done on Netflix, the kind of story of the FBI agents in the 70s who first started really applying psychological concepts to understanding violent criminals, because historically they really didn't like to empathize. They really didn't like to think about getting into their heads. And so it's really cool to see that transition at an interesting
Yeah, that sounds actually
era.
Interesting.
Absolutely. And so that's the cool thing, too, is I think that what we're seeing is a blending in literary and entertainment techniques where the nonfiction stuff is starting to understand, as you did well in your book. And I think as a lot of science communicators are starting to see, they're really most successful when they have a strong story component to them. And then same thing with the nonfiction programming, when we can bring these historical things to life with really strong storytelling, they speak to us more. And I think we're also starting to see that people want to see like reliability and validity in their fiction. They want to see that we'd suspend disbelief, but we can still sort of say, okay, I buy this. And it, you had good science advisors on this show, and that's why it's speaking to me a little bit more.
Yeah, so I love that you say that. So one of the shows I was talking about is Outlander, and mm-hmm. the author. So I got really interested in the show, and then I started, and they have a lot of historical facts in there. So I started looking it up to see, you know, is this true or is this all, you know, did they make all this up? And they actually had a lot of it was true. You know, they had shaped, they had intertwined, they had shaped the story into a collection of things that were actually true that had happened in real history, and then they were doing this alternate history type of spin on it, and it was, and I thought it was so clever. You know, like you say, you know, regardless of if you're writing fiction or nonfiction, it's, it really comes down to the story, and it comes down to these strong characters, whether they're scientists or they're, you know, someone else. It's, that's the kind of the commonality. I think people find a good story is a good story, you know, and if you can learn some science, that's a bonus. Or if you learn something else, that's a bonus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, you know, again, we talk a lot about like sort of disciplines, especially in the sciences, being historically quite siloed, which is so funny because when you go back to the basic roots of physics and chemistry, it really all came down to philosophy and psychology. Like these things were one and the same, and they were really intertwined in the earliest eras, you know, the Greek and the Roman eras of this kind of incredible scientific curiosity. And then everything became really, really compartmentalized over the years. And now I think we're starting to see how important it is to be multidisciplinary and to bring these things back together. And really, the most successful science writers, you know, the Carl Sagans of the world, for example, had such an incredible grasp of psychology and philosophy. And without understanding how humans react to things and what really speaks to us as individuals, it's very hard to communicate science appropriately.
Yeah, you make a good point. I think that's, yeah, you're right. Because, right, if you don't understand, if you can't connect to your audience, you don't have some, you know, this human connection or the psychology, like you're saying, it, you know, you can, it doesn't really matter what you're talking about. It's not, you're not going to connect. They're not really, people won't be engaged. They won't be interested in what you're saying. And it's actually, it's really important.
Yeah. You know, I think Feynman did such a good job of that too. We always talk about Sagan, but I think Feynman also, like, he was such a character. He was such a person. And I feel like it's so important. Sometimes science can feel very stiff and very impersonal. And that's why I love to talk to authors on my show. You know, people like yourself, you write a book that has a lot of knowledge in it that, you know, is accessible yet still quite dense, but there's a person behind those words. And a person with real experiences within the scientists. I feel like it's an honor to be able to sit down and have a conversation with the creator of these important works.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm glad to be able to share and talk about it. It's a real treat to, you know, have someone ask you about the process and discuss these things aside from just talking about the great science.
Oh, absolutely. And we talk about science all the time on the show. So I try to find good balance, you know, between the actual content, which I know some people get frustrated. You know, when I look at the reviews in iTunes, sometimes the more popular reviews that are negative. I mean, most everybody's really positive, which is wonderful. And, you know, obviously, if you're listening to the podcast, you probably enjoy it. But sometimes the negative reviews say, A, that Kara talks too much. It's like, yeah, well, it's my show. I get to do whatever I want.
But that's right.
Agree with that. Yeah.
Absolutely. But, of course.
But B, that like it's sometimes maybe a little too meta. Like I talk to people for too long about their process, or I talk to But the truth of the matter is, I think the handful of people who are like squeaky wheeling about that are not realizing that I honestly think that most people who listen to this show, they like it for that reason. It's not just a bunch of information being thrown at you when we talk about these things. I like to know the process, and I like to know your emotional experience during the process and your frustrations. And, you know, you talked about how there were times when you were like, this almost didn't get made. And it reminds me of an experience that almost everybody listening to this show has had, whether they worked on a PhD thesis, because how many of us decided to drop out or almost dropped out when we were working on something really intense academically, or just a big project you had at work, right? Like, we've all been there where we're like, it's not important enough. I'll quit my job over it. I don't care anymore.
Yeah, no, I think it's good to talk about the process. I mean, actually, so I've done a few of these, obviously, you know, now, and people want to talk about the science, and I love talking about the science, but I don't get asked about the process that often. So it's a real treat to be able to talk to you about it today and to share that. And I also think it, like you said, this goes back to the, I think, kind of the human process, the humanization, kind of the psychology part, if you will. I think the people can really appreciate these things, right? You know, you talk about, like you say, you know, whether it's a PhD thesis or something at work, or, you know, for me, there was that year where every day I wanted to quit writing the book. I mean, I think people can relate to these things, you know, and that's a real strong connection part. I think these are interesting stories.
Oh, for sure. And they really do speak to all of us, because I think they underlie what it is to be, you know, some of our most basic needs and wants and interests and curiosities that, you know, at times, depending on how they're presented, can feel a bit overwhelming. They can even feel esoteric, which is weird because they're so fundamental. But when done the right way, and I think that your book, The Cosmic Machine, really does it the right way, it really speaks to us on an important fundamental human level. And that's just so incredibly important. So I want to ask you, Scott, because I close every episode the same way. I know that my listeners are a little annoyed that I didn't get a chance to do it last week. But, you know, every so often, time does not permit. But because we have the time, I would love to ask you about my final two questions. And I ask every single guest I have on the show the same final two questions. And they're quite big picture questions. So are you ready for that?
Okay.
All right, here we go.
Lay it on me.
Right? Okay. So when you think about the future, and that's in whatever context is relevant to you, so you could be talking about your future, you could be talking about the future of your work, or you could be talking about the future of, you know, politics, of geopolitical situations, of the globe, of the universe, you know, big cosmic future things. Yeah, I mean, really, it's a grab bag. You can take your pick. The first question is, you know, what is the thing, if you had to pick one, which I know is hard to do, that keeps you up the most at night, that is most disconcerting, most worrisome, that you're kind of like pessimistic about? But then on the flip side of that, because, you know, I don't want us to cry ourselves to sleep tonight, what is the thing that you're really honestly optimistic and hopeful and excited for in the future? You can take a moment to think about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the thing that keeps, okay, so we have the thing that keeps me up the most at night. So other than President Trump, if we were, is that off the table?
No, that's a great answer. I would say probably
That's a whole, we didn't go on for so much longer, I'm afraid.
Most popular answers have to do with Trump and climate change.
That keeps me up a little bit, right? To be honest. Yeah. But we'll just leave that there. And then, it's interesting. I think in some ways they might be related. So obviously, like I said, I'm in drug discovery. I think a lot about, you know, the future of drug discovery. That keeps me up a lot at night with the different challenges. And it always seems like there's one other thing that's coming up. You know, we still, I'm sure we all know people that are suffering from certain conditions and stuff like that. And this is really unfortunate. So actually, to be honest, these things I think about quite a bit, you know, the existing therapies that we don't have right now, the conditions that, you know, are very challenging. Alzheimer's is a good example, or Parkinson's. And obviously there's lots of different cancers. And after all these years, our impact is impressive, but we're not there. And so, but now on the flip side, you know, I'm excited about a lot of the technology and a lot of therapies that are coming out. You know, we have some amazing things that are really coming out. And I think in drug discovery, you have these antibody therapies, which have really, in a whole different way, have really impacted disease in a way that we haven't seen before. So you're impacting some of these hard diseases like, you know, psoriatic arthritis, RA, all these things that were pretty devastating. We're really, you know, starting to impact it. And I'm also excited by a lot of the cancer therapies that are coming out. You know, it's a whole different strategy now where, you know, we're not just giving you some drug to try to cure your cancer. We're actually trying to do this in a way now where we're engaging your own body, your own immune system to, you know, stand up, take notice, and actually attack the cancer cells. And that's a whole different strategy, which is having a lot of success. And so I'm very excited about that. So I guess it's both. So that's the thing that's keeping me up at night, but I'm also very hopeful about, you know, drug discovery and drug therapies that are coming up.
Well, that's, I think, such it's an important answer. It's an interesting answer. It's an answer that's really different than we've had on the show before, because I don't think I've really talked to, you know, a computational chemist in the past on the show. So it's really enlightening to hear that perspective. But I also have to say, I'm always really excited when individuals sort of do have the same answer. You know, some people have diametrically different answers to the final two questions, but some people like yourself really realize that the same things that worry them are the things that excite them and keep them optimistic. And I think I'd be interested to see, to run an analysis, to see if the same kinds of people who have a similar answer, like the two sides of the same coin for these questions, are the types of people who are really dedicating their lives' work to working on these problems. Because of course, as a scientist or as any individual who's working in a field where you feel emotionally and psychologically and intellectually driven in your field, it is the problems that are keeping you going and trying to find solutions to those problems. That's what motivates you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would think there would be a lot of people that have kind of that similar feeling. You know, these are the things that are really concerning you, but it's also, and maybe it's the stuff you bring home at night with you sometimes, you know, from work, but it's more than just work. It's a passion for you. And so you are thinking also, you know, very prospectively in the future and how these things will change, how you can change these things.
Yeah, so great. I feel like excited and grateful that we got to have this chat that really was multifaceted. You know, sometimes with us authors, I get their book and their book is basically incredibly married to the work that they do. And we talk about the things, and the things are fascinating and important, but also like somewhat unidimensional. And it was really exciting that you were able to share with me so much insight, both into the kind of work that you do, like in your day job, but also in some of the fundamental physics that you offered in The Cosmic Machine. So, Scott, I have to thank you for joining me. It was just really enlightening.
Yeah, thank you, Kara. It was actually a real pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely. So guys, The Cosmic Machine, the science that runs our universe and the story behind it, is available. Make sure that you pick up your copy and you really brush up on this fundamental knowledge that we should all be, you know, privy to, that we all sort of have a little bit of an obligation, but also I think have the privilege of being able to understand. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.